news on Network 23 tonight is that the next 11 minutes will not be interrupted by commercials. This is Network Chief Ben Cheviot's personal gesture to viewers on Sky Clearance Night.
Run number 6, stand by. Terry, pull up the Mombach story.
Say that one more time, Control.
I said the automatic sensor tripped in. The show has been pulled.
Automatic sensor? But I'm looking for a kid's mother. How can they pull that?
We don't know. And the only person who can tell us won't.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, sometime before 6 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's politics show. Online only, I'm afraid, still. I'm Tony Gosling, just back from New Zealand. Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers is here too. We're also joined by leader of the Lib Dem group on Bristol City Council and councillor for Knowle, Gary Hopkins. So I think maybe we should start, Gary, by you giving us your take on the way that you think that, Bristol seems to be one of the cities which is not too badly affected by the virus itself. But what do you think about the measures that have been taken nationally and here to deal with it?
Well, I think some of the measures have been entirely appropriate. Timing has been bad. Initially, the government were very slow in terms of imposing lockdown, and that didn't affect us quite so much in our region because we were a little bit behind, but certainly had a very negative effect on the figures in London. I think now the problem is that it's all very well for us to actually criticise what the government have done or failed to do at the right time previously, but I think we need to look very, very carefully now on what their plan is for getting us out of the situation that we're actually in and some of the other effects. I think one of their successes has been building these special hospitals quickly and equipping them, but it staggers me that we're actually apparently not going to use them unless the things continue to go badly wrong. Now, quite frankly, we have people who are going to be dying in other aspects of the National Health Service, cancer treatment and various other things, because all their services have been closed down. And while we've got these extra hospitals and the extra capacity, it strikes me that one of the urgent things that we must actually do is use them for what they've been prepared for, to free up at least one hospital in each region so that it can get on with some of the more urgent other work.
Now, Martin, what are your thoughts? I think we'll be listening here to today's statement on Radio 4 or interview with the Health Secretary Matt Hancock about this whole idea of how we get out of lockdown, because certainly looking around the world, seems that the US and Britain may be the last countries to come out of the lockdown. And that could simply be, I mean, this is just my take on this speculation, because we don't know what we're doing. We are just flying by the seat of our pants and we can't see an exit strategy for the situation that we've got ourselves into.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, basically, both the US and Britain were very laggardly in taking the thing seriously. And of course, in that case, you're probably going to end up having a longer lockdown than otherwise might be necessary. And that you can't evade that.
Well, I mean, you can.
The state's already made us path dependent.
You can. Well, Bic, you can evade that to a certain extent by pointing to countries like South Korea and Sweden that haven't had anything like this kind of lockdown, but are now looking at, they've basically taken this approach.
Well, South Korea tested everybody from the get-go. And pursued a testing strategy, which we explicitly stopped doing because we didn't believe in it, although now we do believe in it. So we've clearly changed our strategy from a non-testing strategy to a testing strategy.
Yeah.
Gary?
Yeah, the test and trace is absolutely necessary. And if we're going to get out with any out of this situation, then that's got to be ramped up massively. And the government are talking figures at the moment. But the infrastructure that they're putting in to allow for proper testing is not there. They haven't thought through properly the tracing. I mean, apart from anything else, we've got 750,000 people who volunteer to assist the NHS. As far as I can tell, they've been given nothing to do.
Amazing. One of the good bits of news, though, is that we've had fantastic weather for people to get out and sit in their gardens if they've got them. Obviously, if you're living in a tower block, that's not quite so easy. And the good news being that sunshine kills this virus. Now the experiments have been done in 2 minutes. So it must mean that with all this sun, that's actually kind of helping things along, not only just cheering us up, but meaning that the virus is being thwarted. The funny thing is here, Gary, I wonder what you make of this, is that, of course, that means that actually outside is a worse place for the virus than inside when we're hearing that the sunshine kills the thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think that rather than banning people from going out, we just need to make certain that when they're out, that there are the better controls. I mean, in Bristol, we've got the situation where our cemeteries are still closed. And quite frankly, those are places where people find quite a lot of peace and are able to walk around without causing any danger to anybody, as long as they're behaving responsibly. And Bristol, I think, is one of the very few councils in the city that are resisting the government calls for the reopening of the cemeteries.
Amazing. I mean, one of the most shocking aspects to all of this is, I mean, I was reading just yesterday that it's quite feasible. If I have problems with my internet in my home, for someone to come and fix that, that's deemed an essential service. They don't have to wear a mask. They can come into my home. And yet, if one of my parents is dying, I'm not allowed to go and visit them. And there just seems to be, actually quite a nasty angle to this, where they're removing the kind of human side. Now, one can understand, say, for example, limiting numbers at a funeral, making sure there's social distancing at a funeral, but not being allowed to go and see a loved one on their deathbed is a pretty extreme measure, I think, Gary.
The irony of it is that the mindset of the general public is more towards cooperating and helping than it has otherwise been. I mean, I've been speaking to a lot of residents, particularly elderly residents, in my ward over the phone. And the overwhelming response coming back is people helping each other, which is great. And also commentary from quite a number of the older people in particular, that they found that people are far more sociable at a 2 meter distance than they ever were before. So, you know, offers to go and do the shopping and all that sort of thing.
Well, I mean,
which is very, very encouraging.
So much here, but certainly in New Zealand, what people tend to be doing is going out for walks around their local area on their promenade and taking with them a little sort of fold-up chair, so that when they saw someone they knew either on the other side of the street or in their garden, they would then sort of sit there on the opposite side of the pavement or the opposite side of the street and have a chat over a few metres distance. And this was almost a completely new way. I'd never really seen any this ever happening before in the UK.
Well, actually, New Zealand is an example of a country who's got it actually right, with the death figures, I think, are about 14 total, not per minute, as we seem to have in other places. And they acted extremely quickly in terms of lockdown, were very firm about it. And actually, the Prime Minister communicated extremely openly and honestly with people, which I think is a considerable help.
In Sweden, cafes and restaurants have stayed open, and same in South Korea. But we had today the Swedish Prime Minister saying his country's had a lot of criticism, saying that the death rates in Sweden are quite high, a little bit higher than average. But he's pointing out, he's saying, well, yes, but by allowing young people to catch this and get over it, we have protected the country against a second wave, which is now exactly what we're hearing in the UK. A second and a third wave means that we can't lift the lockdown yet. So what about this whole idea of a second wave and a third wave, Gary?
Well, the point is that as there's a gradual unwinding of the complete lockdown, and there will have to be bits and pieces that are allowed and gradually keeping a monitor on things, we haven't got the testing and tracing in place yet to allow that to happen. And I think that's one of the reasons why the government looks so shambolic at the moment, is because without the testing and tracing, you cannot properly relax the lockdown that we've actually got, because they won't know if it's got back out of control again. They won't know how it's been transmitted.
Yeah, I mean, it's not very good, is it, to have basically filling up wards and overwhelmed hospitals as your only indication as to where you are with the virus. Anyway, let's have a listen now to the Health Secretary, Matt Hancock, speaking on BBC Radio 4 this morning, where he actually, I think you'd agree with me, he sounds a little bit hesitant almost all the way through, as if he's nervous about asking questions. He's actually quite hostile to the interviewer, and he feels almost like he's kind of on the back foot. That's my take of it. But anyway, have a listen to it and see what you think.
There will be an increase in cases of coronavirus. The minute people start moving around more, there will be a number of new infections. The question is only how great that peak might be.
No, I don't think that's right. So this all depends on what's called on the R, the reproductive rate of the virus, how many people on average somebody who has it passes it on to. And we've got to keep that reproductive rate below one, because that means that the virus is in abeyance and the number of new cases is falling. There is evidence that it's somewhat below one, which means that you can make, which means that there may become a point where you can safely make changes. But we're being very, very cautious about that, because if that reproductive rate goes above one, and there's too much of a new transmission because of any changes, then of course you're back precisely, as you say, into the potential of a second spike, and that would be a not only obviously bad for health, but it would also be terrible for the economy.
I mean, that's really why I asked about how large any second peak might be, because isn't there a degree of community transmission that can be handled safely by the NHS, and indeed might well be needed to see if the vaccine that's currently being trialled can work?
Well, no, I don't think that saying that we should let the virus rip in order to test the vaccine is an approach that anybody would recommend. But the truth is, we need to get the number of new cases right down, and then you can use test, track and trace to hold it down.
Tell me what right down. Tell me what right down is. Otherwise,
yeah,
it's difficult for anyone to understand.
Well, and the answer to that is that until we know the results of the ONS test I was talking about a minute ago, where we know exactly how many people in the community have had it and currently have got it, we won't know the answer to how low we need to go with the current social distancing measures. So that is one of those scientific unknowns, but we should have the result of that soon in order to be able to make the decisions on the timetable that you that we've set out.
You are
so it's, you know, these are, it is, I wish there was more that was known about this. What we do know though is that the curve has been flattened. So the rate of, you know, the number of new cases is no longer going up, which is great. And we do know that the NHS has not been overwhelmed. And they were my two primary objectives right
indeed
at the start.
And
this,
that is why you are facing these repeated calls from different quarters for greater transparency about the next phase. We've heard one from Labour this morning on the programme and one from Gus O'Donnell, the former cabinet secretary, yesterday from senior figures within your own party. Is there a problem with doing what Nicola Sturgeon has done, which is release a framework for easing the lockdown?
Yes, well, we have released a framework. We released it last Thursday, which is five tests for the things that need to happen before we can make changes.
Yeah, you know that's different. We know about your five tests, but
it's not different.
Know,
it's not different because if you read the Scottish document, it is essentially a reiteration broadly of those five tests. And
but it
then
does
a list
talk
of
about how to get back to a semblance of normality. It talks about how schools might reopen, about how businesses might operate, whereas what you've done is released preconditions. There is a difference.
It doesn't set out what the Scottish Government is going to do.
No, it's a framework. I just wonder if you think that there is a problem with doing that. Is that why you haven't done the same thing?
I don't have a problem in principle, but what I would say is that it is too soon to make the changes. And it's when, the British public have been unbelievably resolute in supporting the lockdown measures because they understand the impact on, ultimately, on the number of people who die from this disease. And I stand with the British public in that, with that resolve. And of course, there will be a time when we need to make changes. And that's absolutely right and appropriate.
And would that have to
but
be...
And we've set out the five tests precisely to give people the guide to when those sorts of changes can safely be done. Because what I can tell you, Michelle, I will not allow for changes to be made that are unsafe. We've got to keep the public safe. And I understand the economic pressures, but that is my background.
But the data is different, isn't it, for different parts of the UK. I just want to ask you whether there might be a divergence in terms of when different parts of the UK come out of this. Arlene Foster, who will be speaking to shortly on the programme, has suggested that Northern Ireland could come out of lockdown at a faster pace than the rest of the UK. They have lower number of cases, they've had fewer deaths.
Well, I'll address that in a moment, but first I'm going to finish the answer I was giving before you interrupted me. The point is that the improvement in people's in health from getting the number of new cases down and getting it right down is also the best thing for the economy, because the worst thing for the economy would be a second spike. And instead, if you get the number of new cases right down, then you can hold it down through testing, tracking and tracing. And that allows you to release more of the measures. So, I understand those voices who are saying that we should move sooner, but that is not something we're going to do. We are going to move when it is safe to do so. On the second question that you then asked about different parts of the country, many parts of these questions are devolved. And it's true that the incidence, the number of cases as a proportion of the population is different in different parts of the country. London, it's higher. Wales, the southwest of England, Scotland and Northern Ireland, it's lower. But the shape of the curve has been basically the same throughout. So we'll talk to our counterparts, as we always do in the devolved nations. So far, we have moved as one United Kingdom, and I think that's been a very good thing.
And is that the way it should continue, do you think?
Well, it's my preference is that we work together as one country. I think that's where the public's been during this. But I also respect the responsibilities that my devolved colleagues have got. Okay.
Well, that's Matt Hancock, the Health Secretary, there speaking on BBC Radio 4's Today programme earlier today. We've also heard from the FT, though, that there's, well, I mean, this is obviously people trying to represent some of the financial interests hit so hard by the lockdowns, that coming out of lockdown is not as if it's either or. You can do that and you can do it safely, they're saying. Also, the Bank of England governor, new Bank of England governor, has just come out saying a false start from the lockdown, that's what he calls it, would hit confidence. The governor of the Bank of England's warned of a bigger hit to the economy from a premature end to the UK's coronavirus lockdown, saying it would damage people's confidence very severely. So I wonder what Mark Martin, maybe you could start on this, what you make of what you've just heard there, and also this statement from the Bank of England governor saying we must stay in lockdown to help the economy, which seems to be, a bit counterintuitive.
Well, it's not. It's not, because if you have a premature lockdown and then you get a second spike coming through and you have to go back into lockdown, that's likely to have a more devastating effect on the economy than getting it right the first time and then coming out of a lockdown because you've got it right the first time. Coming back to what we were saying earlier, we've got a specific problem here, which is we got it wrong at the beginning of the crisis, drastically wrong. We were going in the wrong direction for quite a while. So it's quite likely that Britain is going to actually come out of lockdown last as compared to countries like New Zealand or South Korea. But can I make just another point quickly, which is we don't know a lot about this virus. It clearly doesn't function like flu. It's not a flu virus. And it's quite clear that some people get reinfected, that there's long-term implications of people who've got it, so that they're having long-term lung problems. All of these things are being discovered as we find out what this damn thing is. And I don't think you can actually say, well, if we could come out of a lockdown and it's quite straightforward. It's not straightforward. It may be that you can't come out of lockdown at all. Now, I'm not saying that. I'm not a medical person, but that's what some medical people are saying. And I think we really need to listen to people who have got the relevant skills, not just make it up as we go along.
Mirror is saying that over 70s may have to have a year-long lockdown. Gary, what do you make of what you just heard from Matt Hancock and also this statement from the Bank of England governor?
Well, I suspect that one of the reasons that why Hancock sounds rattled is that he feels he's trying to do the right thing, but there are various lobbies within government, within the cabinet. Don't forget, at the beginning of this, that there was going to be, oh, we'll go for herd immunity. And then they realised 500,000 people would have been killed by that approach and the switch tack. But basically, there are still people in government who would choose the economy recovering and accepting higher death rates. And also, of course, we've got to take into account that it's not the economy or health. I think Martin's actually quite right, because if you actually do it, bodge it up, then the public belief in following government instructions will disappear, and that we could end up with a degree of chaos and people not following sensible instructions. But let's not forget, I was listening to a cancer specialist the other day who said that if we had the lockdown in its present form for a significant period of time, the number of deaths, avoidable deaths because of cancer, could be higher than that from COVID. And that's why I think that we need to look at how the health service is responding and use the extra facilities that we've actually have been built to actually try and allow the health service to resume some of the activities that it was doing before.
Well, this is a very important point, isn't it? I mean, we've seen this week death rates are up, but the only roughly a third of the extra deaths has been due to this COVID-19. Admissions from children's hospitals, we heard just yesterday, is enormously down. Now, I wonder whether this is, I mean, quite what is behind these statistics. Certainly there is appeals from health service officials saying, please do come to hospital if you're ill, come to the accident and emergency if necessary. But are people just nervous about going to hospital now if they think that they...
So some of them are. I mean,
sorry.
I think in some
cases... the thing is that the nervousness may come from the fact that if someone is admitted to hospital, you may never see them again.
Quite. I mean, in some cases, the A&E figures being down are good news, because some of them were a bit, should we say, some of them were unnecessary visits. On the other hand, I got a friend who had quite a significant kidney infection and thankfully recovered, but it looked rather dangerous for a while. And they chose not to go to hospital because the number of infections that have happened in some hospitals of COVID, and they wanted to keep clear.
There's also
lots of other people who should be getting treatment and screening for various things that are just not getting it. And that's quite a worry. But I think that because of the extra capacity that's built in, we could do both, because, you know, the health service has not been overwhelmed. We have new facilities that especially are targeted at COVID. Let's use them.
Well, we certainly should be. The problem here seems to be that people who have basically had their regular treatments cancelled, I myself have got some minor illness, and you know, it's certainly no skin off my nose to put off the next visit to the specialist for a few months. That's fine by me, but there's a lot of other people who have more serious conditions. One of my neighbours has got quite a severe chronic respiratory problem that he's now very concerned that's not being treated. So it almost seems as if the health service is geared up for this massive number of people to be admitted with the COVID-19 virus, which hasn't actually happened, and a lot of other treatment has been sidelined as a result. Gary, what do you think? That's fair?
Well, no, but the thing is that what the government will react to is what's in the media, and it's very easy, or comparatively easy, to say this person died because of COVID. It's not entirely clear in every case, and there are numbers there, and there are numbers coming out every day. Whereas the person who dies in a year and a half's time because they didn't get the proper screening and treatment on cancer, they're not in the headlines now. But we need to be taking full account of all those circumstances.
Now, I mean, we also heard from Matt Hancock a little bit about this whole idea of, I think it actually might have been the interviewer, about this whole idea of getting reinfected. And now there is a problem here, isn't there? Because we're being told that, you know, we've got to wait for the vaccine, then the lockdown can finish. And, we, you know, although that, I mean, it certainly seems to be one of the things we're hearing. We've also had the first human trials at Oxford University yesterday of some new vaccine that they're testing. It may work, it may not. But we're also being told, Martin, we're being told that the virus can reinfect. So surely what we're doing is a kind of shooting at the moon here. We're really hoping that this vaccine will be effective with the knowledge that this virus can reinfect people. So a vaccine is unlikely to be all that much use.
Well, we haven't got a vaccine for the common cold, and we haven't got a vaccine for HIV/AIDS, despite all the money that's been thrown at it. So you've got to consider the possibility that a vaccine is a red herring. Now, I'm not saying it is or it isn't. I don't know enough to make that call. But you can't presume that this disease, whatever it is going to behave in a predictable fashion. It may reinfect people. It may be, for example, that if you've had it and you haven't even noticed, this is one of the problems with it. People have been spreading who are asymptomatic, which is what makes it so difficult. I mean, with flu, like the Spanish flu in 1918, once people started sneezing and coughing, you knew they were infected and you could isolate them. With this, people wander around, quite a lot of people, we're not sure, wandering around who are basically spreading it, but they don't know they're spreading it. Now, that makes it very difficult to manage it. Now, I don't think we're going to do ourselves any favours by presuming we know more than we actually do about what this thing is. They're still finding out. We've got to basically keep our options open. And as we find out what the real nature of this disease is, we can then take the appropriate action. And it doesn't make sense to me to make hard and fast rules about what you're going to do. Once we've got people infected, then we can end the lockdown. Not if they're still infecting other people.
Also, I mean, I could just give you some comparisons, I suppose, between going to the supermarket here in Britain and doing it in New Zealand. New Zealand was very much better organised. You had hand sanitation. All the trolleys were sanitised over there. When you pick up a trolley and take it into the supermarket, it's been sprayed with the sanitiser. You had a member of staff just to make sure you did that properly. And also sanitation on the way out. The other thing is that the queues in the supermarket were all supervised by staff just to keep an eye on everyone in the queues, just to make sure that people weren't getting too close to each other. There were these big screens up in front of the checkout people so that you basically, what you do is you put your goods on the counter, you then move away, then the checkout person will then come over, check your stuff through. Once it's all checked out, she or he will then move away. You then come in and pay for it and box it up and leave. So it was all very pretty well organized. The queues outside also supervised. Over here, what I've seen is a very unsupervised. So these measures are there, but everyone is just left to do them. And of course, that is a problem. One of the queues I was in this week, was a mentally ill person who was just kind of wandering around and even bumping into people. So, you know, basically rambling, ranting. So there was no real supervision. Although there was somebody there, there was nothing they could actually do to stop this person being disruptive. And of course, in the city centre, we've got quite a lot of damaged people, who are having to now live in hotels. And they are queuing up just along with everyone else, but without the kind of supervision. So New Zealand, very organised. I would suggest here, Gary, a bit shambolic.
Yes, I'd have to agree, unfortunately, in lots of cases. I get regular updates from New Zealand to relatives there. And although they have, there was a 4 degrees of lockdown, and they're lifting only the first one, which takes them almost actually to the theoretical place that UK is actually in. But as you say, better organised, better controlled.
Yeah, so they have a system of basically level 1, 2, 3, and 4. And yeah, when the lockdown started, they have one day of level 3, and they're going to be coming out of level 4 back to level 3 next Monday. From what we hear from Matt Hancock, Martin, there's no real plan to actually come out of lockdown at all here. What we're hearing is that there are these 5 tests, and once we've met all these 5 tests, then the government will start continuing releasing us from the lockdown. But it's a completely different system, a completely different process. And it does seem as if there's an attempt here, both here and in the US, to keep these lockdowns going until the government actually sorts itself out, gets its act together and decides what it's planning to do. There are some plans out there, like there's a traffic light plan saying that that we will be on red traffic light until the 11th of May, when hairdressers and garden centres can open. Amber on the, which will go amber on the 25th of May, where businesses of some types can open, restaurants and schools can open with social distancing rules in place, and then green on the 15th of June, where pubs can start to open, cinemas, sport and gyms with social distancing rules. But this is just one plan, and it doesn't certainly look as if the government is really taking this up or taking it very seriously. We could be headed for certainly at least until the end of the year without any real explanation, or kind of, it's almost as if Matt Hancock and his friends don't see it's necessary to tell us when we're coming out and how we're coming out.
Well, that's because they don't know, Tony. The fact is that they've been absolutely incompetent from the get-go. And when there's going to be a public inquiry into all of this, as there was into the Iraq war, and there's plenty, the charge sheet is looking pretty bad already. Now, that because they've made such a cock up of the initial phases of this crisis, they're now desperate not to do anything which looks smacks of desperation, which could then lead to even further recrimination further down the line.
There's a sort of binary thinking going on here, isn't there? That you've either got to lock down or not lock down, and one or the other, and they don't dare to not lock down because the disease will spread. Well, the Swedes and other countries have proven that that's not necessary. You can have some more at-risk.
I dispute that, Tony.
Martin, more at-risk people in the population staying on lockdown, while people who are much less at risk, say 0.01%, that they might actually be even hospitalised if they catch this, that those sorts of people can be released from the lockdown. But anyway, so you were disagreeing, Martin.
Well, I think if you look at what the situation is in Sweden, I think it's quite useful that different countries have pursued different strategies.
Because
you can actually then compare and contrast. Now, if you compare and contrast Sweden to Finland and Norway, they've had a much worse outbreak than those two neighbouring countries. Also, as Lofgren has said, is the Swedish Prime Minister, they've closed all major sporting events, any meetings of over 50 people and so on. So they're having a lockdown. It's just not as severe. People can go to restaurants, but they have to do table service, no going to the bar in pubs and so on. So in other words, it's a different kind of lockdown. But he's made it clear that they will have to carry on with that lockdown longer because it's not so severe. So
ours is open-ended, our lockdown at the moment.
Well, it's open-ended because we messed up the first phases of the crisis with Boris Johnson having a 2-week holiday at Chequers, missing 5 Cobra meetings, and also his famous speech where he said, we're going to take it on the chin and go for herd immunity, which has been completely discredited. So we wasted weeks
Our
lockdown is going to have to go on and on and on. Bad news for the Conservative government.
Some countries, Martin, have been very successful going for herd immunity, actually.
Well, I think this is going to be... it looks like Britain and the US have behaved rather... have got a very bad record in all of this.
And it's worth saying also...
Britain and the US don't believe in government intervention, and their instincts were to just try and bluff it out. They've failed on both counts.
I've heard on the news today this whole thing about Donald Trump supposedly saying that he thinks people should be injected with disinfectant. I mean, if you actually listen to what he said, he didn't say that at all. There's a bit of fake news around. I think
I did listen to what Trump actually said. I mean, he's quite frankly clinically mad.
Well, he doesn't know the stuff, does he, obviously?
Well, exactly, but why is he saying it then?
He didn't say that people should be injected with disinfectant. That's just a misrepresentation by the news media.
Well, he didn't say it as such, but he said, I don't really know about this, but what about this as an idea, which I don't think is a terribly constructive contribution.
He was talking about other treatments being available rather than just a vaccine. But anyway, Gary, what are your thoughts then about this whole idea of the... lockdown being extended forever at the moment. It's what it seems like. And there's some alternatives around the red and amber green idea I just talked about. And possibly over 70s having a longer lockdown, and vulnerable people, say those with asthma, diabetes, things like that, having a different regime.
But I have rather more confidence than Martin in exactly getting a vaccine. I'm pretty certain that one will be produced, something that's effective, but it will take probably a year. So we've got to work out a path between now and then. It's very difficult to work out a path if you don't know what the heck the figures are and what's actually happening out there, which is the position that Britain is in at the moment. I think the only thing that we can be grateful for is that we don't have a Trump as president actually undermining sensible measures that have been taken in a number of states and encouraging rednecks into mass protests on the street. I mean, you just really could not believe that a president would actually do that. And that's possibly one of the good things that might actually come out of this, that this is hopefully the final nail in the coffin for Trump. But we'll see what actually happens in this country. But I do believe that we will have a vaccine. But it is true that people can get reinfected from this virus, and our natural immune system seems to act in a very, very strange way and in a very varied way towards it. But that does not mean that we cannot get a virus that will, a vaccine that will be effective. And I believe that we will have. And we've got to work out the path between now, where we are now, and hopefully that position in a year's time. And it will be varied. Just lockdown or not lockdown doesn't explain it. There are different measures that you can actually take to control things. But all of them are dependent upon knowledge, testing and tracing.
Absolutely right. I mean, that's one thing we don't really seem to have got right yet. Anyway, there is another aspect to all of this, and that is the enormous amount of money that the central government has borrowed in order to apparently help pay people that aren't being paid. But much of that money seems to be going to basically just try and prop up the stock market. The figure at the moment is £225 billion has been borrowed. The normal amount annually is around about $800 billion the government borrows. So this is whatever 25% extra this year that they've borrowed just within the last couple of weeks. The annual national debt has been going up and up, and it now looks, because of this extra borrowing, that we'll be topping £2 trillion. This year. Remember, it was only around about $400 billion in 2008 before the 2008 bailouts and the financial crisis then. And that means we're going up and up and up. And the amount that we're actually paying, the government is paying every year in debt interest, is going up. It's now around about £15 billion annually of our taxes and government revenue. It's just going to pay off the national debt, and it's going up, Martin, $2 trillion in the next few, certainly within the next couple of months. It looks like we'll hit that $2 trillion barrier and go on up, up and up. And does it actually matter that the national debt is soaring in this way?
In the long run, it does. But in the short run, if you've got a, if you've got a fire, you've got to put it out. And in normal times, if you have a recession, the fact that tax receipts go down and benefits go up is a cushion for the economy. What we should have had in place after the crisis in 2008 is a universal basic income. And a cross-section of MPs have called for that in the last couple of days, including Lib Dems, Labour, SNP, Plaid Cymru and Greens. And if we'd had that in place, then we would have been well positioned to deal with this crisis. But of course, in actual fact, we spent 12 years since 2008 pretending that the banks were fine and the bailout had worked. And of course, that's just wrong. The banking system was already collapsing last September when this all started to come to fruition. And the Federal Reserve in the US was already pumping money into the repo market because the banks were insolvent. And they've been insolvent for 12 years. And that's what should have been dealt with and hasn't been dealt with for various reasons in different countries. But basically everybody's kidded themselves that was all fixed And of course it wasn't.
Gary, £225 billion the government's borrowed to try and deal with this. I mean, it certainly looks as if that might only be the first tranche of money that they need to borrow in order to try and keep the national economy afloat.
It's obviously of concern, but I agree with Martin that, you know, when there's a fire, you've got to try and put it out. The thing that really worries me, without proper planning on the health side of it, which we don't have at the moment, and without thoroughness on that side, the period of time in which we're going to have to subsidise things is going to be lengthened. And we really need to be in a position where, as we gradually emerge from the position that we've actually got now, the more of the businesses that were viable before can actually revive and get going again. I think the problem is that the government are supporting some businesses, which I think we all know in several months' time in a different environment are not going to be there for the long term. It's fine if you're supporting people's wages to reactivate them again in a number of months' time. But if you're supporting structures which are going to die in the long term, that is a waste of money.
10 billionaires have gained $51 billion this week. This is in Forbes, on the Forbes website, as markets edged up from the stock market crash. Well, I don't think it was quite a crash. That's over-egging it a little bit. This is Jeff Bezos, the world's richest person, logged the second biggest increase. He gained $6.8 billion, bringing his net worth to $124.7 billion. There is a whole list here, Martin. I'll put a link up to it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Luxury goods tycoon Bernard Arnault's debt net worth jumped by $6.3 billion up to $92 billion as shares of his LVMH company increased by nearly 7%. It sounds to me as if some people are making an absolute killing out of these government loans and bailouts, Martin. This money is never going to trickle down to the ordinary folk like you and I.
No, it's not. And I think what's happened in the US is very significant because the Federal Reserve has basically taken powers which it never used to have to bail out secretly. There's no clause that allows anybody to know who's being bailed out and on what basis, similar to what happened under the TARP regime in 2008. And they've subcontracted the actual working of this bailout to BlackRock, who are the biggest vulture hedge fund on Wall Street. And they are deciding who gets bailed out, but nobody's allowed to know who's being bailed out. That's probably because the Federal Reserve, as Adam Tooze, the political economist and historian, has pointed out, they're not just bailing out inside the US. The Federal Reserve is effectively becoming the central bank for the world. So they're bailing out certain countries, certain firms are being bailed out. Others are going to be thrown to the dogs, but we're not to know who or on what basis those decisions are being made. This is basically a power grab by the financial elite.
They're not the only ones.
Going to have to be dealt with further down the line.
Well, there's another article I'll put a link up to on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. And that is in the New York Post. Over 43,000 US millionaires will get a stimulus averaging $1.6 million each. The Coronavirus Aid Relief and Economic Security Act trumpeted its assistance for working families and small businesses, but it apparently contains an even bigger benefit for wealthy business owners. The committee found the act allows pass-through businesses, ones taxed under individual income rather than corporate income, an unlimited amount of deductions against their non-business income, such as capital gains. The Washington Post has said they can also use losses to avoid paying taxes in other years. That gives the roughly 43,000 individual tax filers who make at least $1 million a year a savings of $70.3 billion, or about $1.6 million apiece. So there's a massive amount of tax breaks being given to these 43,000 American millionaires as well, Gary. It does rather make you wonder if some people are just cashing in on this pandemic.
Well, a lot of people got very rich during the Second World War, didn't they? The vast majority of people didn't. And I think that I think to be fair, the effort from the government in this country has attempted to go in the right direction, even though they haven't got a lot of the details right, given that things should have been done a few years ago and they weren't. And their response has attempted to go in the right direction. But clearly, when you look at the United States and Trump, there's not even a pretense there. And I just hope that people are stupid enough not to notice.
Let's look at some other news this week, because I think it's very important to point out some things which would probably have made major headlines if it wasn't for the virus swamping all the news coverage and the bulletins. Survivors' victims say any chance to learn about the arena bombing in Manchester will be limited after they're refused special legal status. A total of 56 people who survived the atrocity applied for core participant status, an inquiry into the attack, but have been refused this week. I mean, this is pretty shocking, Martin. I think I'll probably ask you to comment on this one first, really, because, I mean, as we know, there are all sorts of problems with the security services being warned several times about specific individuals that went on to then allegedly carry out this attack. The arena bomb survivors have been refused core participant status for the upcoming inquiry, but the chairman of the inquiry insists their voice will be heard. Well, the actual people themselves say they've got a lot of serious questions they want answering about MI5's involvement with not protecting people against someone who they've been repeatedly informed was potentially dangerous. Anyway, so they're not allowed to have a legal representation at this inquiry at all, the actual survivors who were there on the day.
Well, that's because there's an intimate relationship between the British intelligence services and the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, who are the terrorist organisation behind the bombing, because they've been working with them for years, going back to the 1980s, to overthrow Gaddafi. And the father of the bomber, the named bomber, was working directly with MI6, because he was in the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group. At the very least, the links between the British intelligence services and the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group would be embarrassing, and it could even be devastating. Incidentally, in the United States, a court in the United States has prevented victims of the 9/11 attacks from suing the Saudi government, and they wanted to release various documents which implicated the Saudi government. The courts in the US have said it was against the national security of the United States to release the documents, and that's because the documents probably show that the Saudi government was complicit, and possibly elements within the US government are therefore implicated. These things are still going on out there. And as you well know, there's lots of rows and arguments flying about what this virus actually is, which probably we will discuss later in the programme.
I mean, the legal side, Gary, basically what this means is that core participants, if they're not going to be allowed to do this, all these things, these 56 victims are not going to be allowed to do, are... they won't be able to receive any advance disclosure of evidence. They won't, or their lawyers won't. They won't be allowed to make statements or apply through lawyers to ask questions of any witnesses. It does sound as if the survivors of the attack themselves have been almost completely shut out of this the inquiry by Mr. Justice Saunders.
Well, whenever you get any kind of serious emergency, some other people regard it as a good opportunity to bury bad news, don't they? And I think that on a general principle, if people are stopping inquiries, stopping information, there's something to hide.
Well, that's one of the on that theme, there's been a kind of difficulty for councillors like you, our elected representatives, getting information out of Bristol City Council. In fact, certainly over the last two or three years, less and less is trickling through. Questions get left unanswered, ignored, that sort of thing. I wonder what you make of the whole Bristol Energy debacle. This is a company which I believe it's in the 30s of millions of pounds of our council tax money has been going into this business, and yet it's still to return a profit. Do you think that it's time to pull the plug, or should we just persist with Bristol Energy, Gary, until some money comes in from them?
Well, I, along with other opposition councillors, called a special meeting of council about a month ago, which we had to postpone because of the virus onset. That meeting was not cancelled, it was postponed, and we intend to reactivate that meeting in the near future. And we must make certain that the public are aware of what's happened to their money and what the real prospects or none of any of that money being recouped. And it's absolutely essential that the public know what's actually going on with this, because these are vast amounts of money.
Now, look, I mean, you are not always given the information that you request from the mayor's office and from City Hall generally, Gary. But what do you know about the financial position of Bristol Energy and whether it's actually a viable business or not?
Well, I think that the people can work it out for themselves. That it was originally going to be producing dividends for the council within a few years, and basically the amount of money that's been put into the company, which is publicly known, has gone up and up and up over a period of time. We have no indications of any possibility of it turning round.
And I know that that figure is over £30 million now that's been put into this business with no return. Martin, I mean, we were hearing, weren't we, a couple of months ago from Tim Kent, the Lib Dem councillor, that he doesn't believe that it's a viable business at all because the energy market has become so competitive that Bristol Energy simply can't compete. It can't win new customers because it can't provide energy at any lower price than the existing big guys in this field, and they're basically minnows trying to fight a losing battle.
I think that's right. I mean, I don't know the detail, but it seems to me wrong, conceptually wrong, to imagine that you are going to compete with the oligopoly of the main energy companies. It's just, it's kind of carrying free market dogma to with a kind of sort of socialist tint on it. It's a not-for-profit company. It's a not-for-profit company quite literally because it doesn't make any profit. And of course, what you really need to do, as an old socialist, I have to say this, is you need to nationalise the energy companies, and then you've got, then you're talking. But trying to compete with them by setting up your own version is wrong-headed in principle.
Well, the bizarre thing was, we actually, in the Dem administration in 2010, were looking at an energy company, but something completely different to what the previous mayor actually launched 5 years later. At the time in 2010, we had things called feed-in tariffs, where basically one of the major concepts was slapping up photovoltaic cells on the roofs of council houses, selling cheap electricity to the tenants and actually making a profit, which was guaranteed for quite a number of years ahead, by feeding that into the national grid. Unfortunately, by the time that the mayor actually, previous mayor got round to launching an energy company, it was completely different. And he decided on this marketing organization, no local generation or micro generation at all. No real proper commitment to green energy, which, you know, what local people were quite happy to back. So it was a completely different beast altogether. And unfortunately, I think about 11 million had actually been lost by the time that the present mayor took over. He didn't pay the slightest bit of attention to what was actually going on and just kept on shoveling money in. And of course was hoping that that the election would intervene. And before the ship finally hit the fan in a very, very large way, that he would have been re-elected. But all that's now going to have to come out because you can't keep on
The present mayor, Marvin Rees, has made a statement this week about Bristol Energy. He says that setting up Bristol Energy was not sensible, quote. But he says
in his present form, he's right. And that was set up by the previous mayor. But of course, it had only been going about a year when he took it over. So he is three quarters responsible for the huge mess that's there. The previous mayor actually did set it up completely and absolutely wrongly. And one of the things that we will actually be exposing is the model that was originally suggested back in 2010 and how that completely changed into this bizarre and lunatic marketing organisation, which the previous mayor set up with no possibility of it ever actually succeeding in the marketplace as it is, and the present mayor gaily took on and continued shoveling money into it.
I mean, we started here by talking about secrecy, and the article goes on to say that the council's cabinet last month agreed behind closed doors to bring forward an unspecified amount of additional investment. They call it investment. I would call it throwing good money after bad. Earmarked for further down the road, taking it closer to the £37.7 million ceiling the local authority set for the total amount of money it will pump into the firm. But it's not known how close the local authority is to that limit or whether it's now reached it, because the agenda item was exempt from press and public as it contained commercially sensitive information, Gary.
Well, quite. And basically, I'm toddling off to the council's independent auditors. You remember I had to do this before when there was a misdescription of the dodgy payments that were given to the ex-chief executive, Anna Klonowski, where they said that she was entitled to the money and wasn't. That was in the accounts. And the independent auditors refused to sign off the company's accounts until that was actually changed. Now, I believe we have a misdescription here, because calling this an investment when it's absolutely clear to everybody that this is not an investment at all, and there's no prospect of actually becoming a profitable and viable organisation, that is a misdescription in the accounts, and that's why I'm going to the auditors.
Well, glad to hear it. I mean, it just seems to me incredible that it'd be lovely to have the Mayor Marvin Rees on here to explain why he hasn't yet pulled the plug on this. What do you think might be his answer? I mean, he's saying in this article that the energy company wasn't sensible, but we need to be responsible, and he's continuing to fund it.
Well, what he was actually doing was shoveling in the money until after the election, because at the moment it doesn't actually appear on the council's accounts as a loss. It is a loss in reality, but it doesn't show in the council's accounts as a loss. And basically his plan was to get past the election, which had just been cancelled, and then crystallise the losses and say, oh, it's all finished with now. He can't actually do that now, because he is going to have all this come out. You cannot just, especially when the council's going to be under even more financial pressure, you cannot keep on shovelling £1 million a month and more into a company that has no prospects of ever making a profit.
Well, at the moment, Bristol's Mayor Marvin Rees is the elected Mayor of Bristol, but as of a couple of weeks' time, he won't be. What do you make of the cancelling of the elections, Gary? I mean, Bristol is going to move from a democratic city into a non-democratic city in May.
I don't think it is a democratic city at the moment. I think that the mayoral system effectively stopped proper democracy several years ago. I think, unfortunately, the government didn't have much choice but to cancel the elections. It's very regrettable.
Well, I think, given the pressure that we're actually under... Because in France, they've just had elections in Paris. In France, they've just had local elections there.
Well, possibly. But I don't think it would have been sensible to try to hold the elections in Bristol, as an example, this year. Certainly, even less so in places like London. The last thing you actually need when you've got a pandemic running on is unnecessary activity. And I agree that it's regrettable, but I don't think the government had a choice.
But, I mean, this election for May would have been quite a lot of the people, you know, and discussions around it would have been about whether we wanted an elected mayor or not. I mean, that certainly would have been on the tongues of many of the candidates. Are we going to have an elected mayor in the future? Now that decision, I suppose, is put off, not only the mayor decision, and that decision itself is put off for another year. But the other thing which strikes me as a bit strange about the one-year delay is, of course, that is going to put us back into potentially another flu season. Rather than the government recommended it to be 6 months so that it would be in the autumn, no, they're saying, no, we're going to be doing this in another year's time.
Well, I don't think we'll be out of this crisis in 6 months' time. So I think a year was inevitable. And, you know, as I say, regrettable, but I don't think the government had much other choice, really, in terms of acting responsibly. And yes, I know 2/3 of the people that we've asked in Bristol said they would vote for getting rid of the position of mayor. I think they'll vote for that in exactly the same percentages in a year's time.
If we have another election, because, of course, everything is sort of up for grabs at the moment. Anyway, let's have a listen now to the mayor himself. He was speaking on BCFM earlier this week. And here is, he discusses, and in the context of the anniversary of the murder of Stephen Lawrence in London, the racist murder, he discusses the implications of journalism to the cover-up of that murder, the failure, really, to investigate it properly, and, of course, the racist press that he thinks encourages these sorts of attacks in the first place. So let's have a listen to that. And it's the Mayor, Marvin Rees, speaking to the presenter of the One Love Breakfast, Patrick Hart.
Marvin, from my info, 27 years ago today, the murder of Stephen Lawrence. Hate crime, racial justice, the police, what in our city, how have things moved on? We've had the McPherson report, we've had right-wing media rubbishing that now and saying that report, you know, shouldn't have been listened to. Where does the land lie in 2020?
My blood begins to boil when you say that, the right-wing media.
Mine too.
Because it wasn't too long ago that I had quite a few posh media types descend on me when I dared to criticise the poor quality of a journalist.
Yeah.
This kind of self-righteousness of the profession is one that rings large, and a lack of self-awareness. So where it rings is, my thought was, I've always said that racism is about individual incidents.
Yeah.
The murder of Stephen Lawrence, you know, Anthony Walker, and the axe put in his head. But actually, you know, and that stuff is massively important. What McPherson got into is the institutional nature of it by definition. That every day, people with brown skin are born destined to die earlier, end up in mental health institutions or in the criminal justice system before they're likely to end up in higher education. And they're likely to be on the wrong end of social immobility. So this is the systemic robbery of life and opportunity that exists in the country, the systemic exclusion from positions of influence and power and leadership and decent pensions and decent housing. That hasn't changed, to be perfectly frank. We are where we are. We're still where we are. And the danger is that as we go through COVID and the costs of COVID, the health costs, but also the socioeconomic costs, fall disproportionately on the shoulders of BME people and working class people, that those inequalities will become entrenched. The right wing, whether they masquerade as journalists or however they masquerade, will not care about this. I think there was an article over the weekend that someone put out to me in the FT saying, well, let's, you know, we just got to grow the economy again. Forget about gender pay gap and all these kind of, you know, PC things. Let's just get the economy moving. Well, that's not what we want. We need to rebuild differently. And some of the people asking for things to be different, I don't think they, I think they should really appreciate the scale of difference we're actually looking for. It's not just about getting people riding bicycles.
Yeah.
It's about a wholesale redistribution of wealth and power. And some of our leading, activists will probably have to look at their own parents' bank accounts as well when we think about that redistribution of wealth and power that the planet needs.
Mm. It's great, isn't it, to say what we all need from a position of privilege, Marvin. That's the thing, isn't it, sometimes. Many of our reporters and social commentators will say that.
Well, two very well-off people talking about redistribution of wealth there. But anyway, I mean, what do you make of the comments linking the attack on Adam Postans at a cabinet meeting, who is the Bristol Post local democracy reporter, with the sort of right-wing racist press and racism around the Stephen Lawrence case? Because I think I'm not sure that Adam would have taken very kindly as a local democracy reporter or as any journalist would to being compared to the people that were racists involved in the Stephen Lawrence case, racist right-wing journalists.
I think the problem is that Marvin Ackley completely undermines some serious arguments, one or two of which he actually makes himself, and lots of others, people better qualified, have made as well. Very serious injustices actually are devalued by him using his petty with his petty inability to actually deal with any criticism of himself or his institution. It's quite shocking, and I'm afraid that that condemns him to be hated by a lot of people because of that. And that doesn't mean to say that he hasn't got one or two useful things to say, but mixing those two things up is just quite shocking.
The criticism, Martin Summers, the criticism, I mean, you're a Labour Party member, you're in the same party as the mayor. This criticism of journalists generally, he's also saying that social media is one of the biggest problems. But of course, you know, this is where people go to express themselves. And I suppose, you know, I would say, well, if someone is being rude, you can always just block them. You know, you don't have to necessarily take what they're saying to heart and take it too seriously. But social media does play an important role. And of course, the mayor has actually spent quite a lot of money on researching social media, and he spends money also in, I keep seeing his posts popping up on my Facebook account further and further up. Almost every morning I switch it on, there's the mayor. He's obviously spending money on the social media, but he doesn't actually like the criticism that's coming through there.
Well, I think we've got to distinguish various aspects of this. I think the general position that there is institutional racism in our society hardly needs to be stated. It's so obvious that it's still there, and the mayor is perfectly within his rights to bring it up. To make the Bristol Post a whipping boy because they are the right-wing media, I think that's going a bit far. The Bristol Post, I wouldn't say it was right wing. I wouldn't say it was left wing. But if they're making criticisms of the mayor,
that's
not the right wing media. That's the Bristol Post. McPherson report.
Martin, let's just point out that it's like owned by Reach PLC, which is also the owner of the Mirror. And if anything, I mean, it certainly used to be owned by Northcliffe, which was the Daily Mail empire. I mean, I think if anything, the Reach PLC is to the left rather than to the right.
Well, but it's certainly not the Daily Mail. So in other words, that's a rather that criticism doesn't really hit the mark. Coming back to the McPherson report. The McPherson report brought in this whole idea of institutional racism. And it's quite interesting that a lot of the people who've been screaming and shouting in the Labour Party about institutional racism in relation to anti-Semitism have used the McPherson report's basic analysis to accuse the Labour Party of institutional anti-Semitism. Now, in actual fact, the McPherson report basically is... it's being manipulated there by a group which in actual fact, in other circumstances, wouldn't accept that there's institutional racism against people who are non-Jewish. Now, obviously, we've had the recent report that was leaked about the people in the Labour Party at the top who were basically sabotaging our election campaign in 2017, which under First Past the Post, with a few more thousand votes, we might even have won. So there's a lot of dirt to be dug there.
But Martin, of course, before we ask Gary about
other things at the moment,
before we ask Gary about that, I wonder if you think that I mean, this is the 2017 general election that this report is talking about. Absolutely shocking quotes from people who are clearly within the Labour Party machinery, apparatchiks and various sorts, who were trying to make sure that Jeremy Corbyn lost that election. I mean, we've had another election, didn't we, back in December last year, 2019. I wonder if you think that was all very well talking about that from 2 years or so ago, but it may have been that some of the same people and some of the same tactics were used last year.
Well, yes, of course. I mean, the same people were in place. Basically, the paid workers in the Labour Party are a bit of a mafia, and they've been a mafia for a long time. And they've got a definite view, which isn't necessarily the view of the membership. And that's been pretty clear all along. But we've now got chapter and verse on it.
Martin, what about the MPs, though? Some people say that actually the MPs were also very anti-Corbyn.
Oh, there were certainly some were. And some, like Keir Starmer, at first were against Corbyn and then decided they were going to go with the flow. Others left the party and stood as, you know, stood for other parties and so on. We basically got the electoral system makes the Labour Party a rather unhappy man.
Well, it's, no, I think that's totally unfair, because if you look at what Boris has done, getting rid of the Euro files from the Tory party, and what and what Nigel Farage has done in getting rid of the racists and the Toby Robinson supporters from UKIP, and basically just sidestepping and starting a new party, it's really surely just about Corbyn not being a disciplinarian, not actually having the courage.
Well, that's what he's been accused of. He's been accused of being too disciplinarian, Tony.
No, I mean, what I'm saying is, it seems that he just hasn't had the courage to take on the right wing within his own party.
Listen, we've had a massive row about this, and you're not a member of the Labour Party. I am. We've had massive rows about it because, unfortunately, the electoral system forces us into one party, where in other parts of Europe, we wouldn't be in the same party. They could say what they think and we could say what we think. And we could just go to the ballot box and find out who got the most support.
We can't do that
because the electoral system's rubbish.
What do you make of this thing in the Labour Party with all these full-time workers in the party actually working against Corbyn to stop him winning an election?
Well, I think a lot of them would regard themselves as doing their best to make the Labour Party electable. I think, as Martin says, the electoral system produces bad politics, not just within the Labour Party, but elsewhere. I mean, the Conservative Party now has gone, as you say, in a very clear direction, and for the moment has massive support. How long that will actually last when reality starts dawning is another matter.
Okay, well, that's it for this first hour. What we'll do is we'll string on the second hour straight away afterwards, but we'll say for now, goodbye to Gary Hopkins, Lib Dem leader in the Lib Dem party on Bristol City Council, and also to Martin Summers, and we'll be back in a minute with a look at the international effects, even though we've talked a little bit about that, and it was interesting to hear Gary's take on some of the other countries and their approach to the virus. So we'll be back in a minute.
Power belongs in the hands of people.
I don't have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. Dollar by the nickels worth. Bang, going bust. We know things are bad, worse than bad.
Bad.
They're crazy, 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 crazy.
10 seconds to commercial.
Sometimes extreme behavior can be the warning sign of a mental illness. Learn to see the sickness.
The President of the United States!
Regrettably, we now believe that only force will make him leave.
The sickness.
Regrettably,
bloodshed.
We now believe
strife.
That only force
riot.
Will make him leave.
Right!
I am certain our cause is just,
a gallon of gas.
And I am certain our cause is moral,
loss of life.
And I am certain our cause is right.
Give me the goddamn money. A new world order.
I don't know.
It's going to be all right tonight.
Right. Again.
I'm from the United States of Kiss My Ass.
Stupidity. Again.
Demonstrations of this kind are demoralizing the whole country.
Corruption. Again.
Don't hate the media. Become the media.
Power. It's up to you.
Choice.
It's up to you.
Change the world.
It's up to you.
Please do your part.
What the truth is.
Television is not the truth. Television is a goddamn amusement park.
Regrettably, we now believe that only force will make him leave. Regrettably, We now believe that only force will make him leave.
The protesters are a tiny but vocal minority. The American people overwhelmingly support the President of the United States.
Ladies and gentlemen, how do you feel?
Bum, you get a job.
Oh, yeah.
Kids we've sent out into the world.
From 1991 on Ninja Tunes, that's Steinsky, It's Up to You. So welcome back to the BCFM politics show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling, now back in the UK from New Zealand after a quite interesting flight through Qatar, the home of Al Jazeera, who seemed to be just trying to run their airline perfectly normally. And we had a flight in from New Zealand into Qatar, which was absolutely packed. And somebody said on the flight, well, the reason that they don't need to have social distancing on this flight is because there's hardly any coronavirus in New Zealand, which sort of made some sense to me. But then once we got on an aircraft from Doha to Heathrow, it was very, very different, with a lot of spacing. In fact, like only every three rows was seemed to be being used, and people were very well spaced apart on that aircraft. In fact, Qatar Airways seemed to be running almost a normal service, with the gate next to us at Doha was another jet heading off to Manchester with a whole load of more people there. So it seems to have become a bit of a hub for the global airline industry, Doha, mainly because Qatar Airways, of course, is backed by vast amounts of oil money from Qatar itself. But Martin, this whole business is also, there's lots going on in the Middle East generally, isn't there, in the background to all of this. Before we get into talking about the virus itself, we've also heard Trump this week talking about shooting down Iranian gunboats. So I'm not quite sure how you shoot down a gunboat. I thought you sank them. But anyway, that's what Trump said.
It is. And of course, he's complaining that his ships are being harassed by Iranian gunboats, which are basically speedboats. But of course, they are basically just outside Iranian territorial waters. So it's the sort of thing you can expect to happen.
Coming into Doha, we actually flew over the Straits of Hormuz, although you couldn't really see, it was dark, but you could see the outlines on both sides of lights from Iran and Saudi Arabia and Qatar. So this is basically a very important point in the world. It was quite fascinating to kind of just be floating in the sky above the Straits of Hormuz. Why is the Straits of Hormuz seen as so important still?
Well, it's because a lot of a big proportion of the world's oil goes through it on its way to the market. And that was a problem during the Iran-Iraq war, of course. When the Armilla Patrol, you know, the British sent a couple of gunboats out there basically to protect the Iraqi tanker fleet from being attacked by the Iranians rather than the other way around. but of course it's still of highly strategic importance because of where it is and because of the oil industry.
But hang on a minute, because the oil industry is no more, almost. You know, the demand for oil has absolutely fallen, so it's almost as if there's no need for any tankers to go through there anymore.
Well, I mean, as you say, we've had the interesting situation where you now have to pay $37 if you're an oil producer in the United States. You give people $37 to take a barrel off your hands because they've got no storage capacity. But of course, that's not the case in the world oil market, because storage is carried out on tankers effectively in the just-in-time supply system. So they haven't reached that limit yet. The oil market is in turmoil because of oversupply, because of the price war between the Russians and the Saudis, which is strategically geared towards taking down the US shale industry. This is a symptom of the wider collapse of the financial markets, because of course the petrodollar is dependent on the oil price and so on.
Propped up by governments, aren't they? The governments don't want these markets to collapse, so they're pumping money into them.
Well, that's right. And of course, in the short run, they've managed to get some momentum in the market, which basically means that those who've made bad choices and bad decisions over the past few years, for example, buying back their own shares in order to ramp the share price, they are now being bailed out by the taxpayer. And ultimately that will then be dumped on the shoulders of the non-wealthy population, unless there's some kind of massive political change.
Well, one of the key things I think take homes from this virus is the role that the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has played in the policy that we're now seeing. This lockdown, particularly in the UK and in the US, is basically Bill Gates' personal foundation policy. Interesting, looking at the funding for the British government's Imperial College modelling team, including this chap Neil Ferguson that keeps popping up on TV and radio. This is directly from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation going to Imperial College. Identically, John Hopkins University, which has been producing all the graphics for many of the main TV companies, exactly the same, you know, doing exactly the same thing, funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. But we've also seen, Martin, there's the several articles around saying that actually Bill Gates is the target of the most conspiracy theories to do with the virus. So this almost seems like an attempt to deflect criticism from Gates by the mainstream press.
Well, I mean, Gates is a very prominent character, so prominent that now that Trump has cut WHO funding by the United States, he is the biggest funder of the World Health Organization, which, if you think about it, is a bit bizarre. The World Health Organization is supposed to be a public sector body bringing together governments to come to some consensus about world health. But the main funder is a private individual with very strong interests in big pharma and the vaccine industry. That surely must represent a massive conflict of interest.
Well, CNBC has been saying this week that billionaire Bill Gates has been outspoken about steps global leaders need to take to combat the spread of coronavirus. Now, an analysis of TV and social media by the New York Times shows that Gates is the leading target of conspiracy theorists who are making false claims linking the billionaire to the pandemic. Well, I don't think anybody is actually saying Bill Gates released this, although some might do. I think the main problem with Gates is that he's predicted this. Many is being seen almost like a religious prophet, and that everything he's suggested, the way governments should be responding, Martin, is the way they are actually responding. So let me just read a little bit from the article. It says the conspiracy theories falsely linking Gates to the coronavirus origins in some way or other were mentioned 1.2 million times on television or social media from February to April, according to analysis by the New York Times and Zignor Labs, media analytics company. That's roughly 33% more than the second most popular coronavirus conspiracy theory topic at the time, which linked 5G wireless technology with the pandemic. In fact, in April, conspiracy theories linking Gates to coronavirus, including some claiming Gates had prior knowledge that there would be a coronavirus pandemic, or claiming the billionaire wanted to implant the global population with vaccine microchips to fight the COVID-19 disease, peaked at 18,000 mentions on TV and social media per day. So, I mean, some of this, it's almost like some of this may be true, some of it may not be true. Can you see the wood for the trees here, Martin?
Well, I think there are various theories about what's going on out there. Leaving Gates aside, let's just talk about what's being said by governments. The US government has definitely run with the idea that the virus was a bioweapon potentially being developed at the Wuhan biolaboratory. The Chinese have responded by saying, well, we think you may have brought this in during the military games, which took place in Wuhan in the end of last year. And this morning, the Chinese ambassador in Moscow has said that we've now got epidemiological studies which suggest that the source of the virus is not in Wuhan, but somewhere else, quite possibly in the United States of America. And of course, Fort Detrick, which is their version of the Wuhan laboratory, was closed down in June last year because of some violation of safety procedures, which they haven't bothered to tell anybody what they were. And they've also, because the Chinese ambassador was using basically scientific evidence and saying our scientists are now looking at the COVID virus, and what came to Wuhan was basically derived from a virus which didn't develop inside China. Now, this is a developing story.
Martin, isn't this just a blame game here?
Well, it is a blame game in one sense, and you could say, well, they're just trying to point the finger at each other for it. But there's also a serious question here. Is it a bioweapon? And if it is, has it leaked accidentally or deliberately? And I'm afraid my suspicion is that it is a bioweapon. Pepe Escobar is another analyst. He has pointed out that both ABC News and the Times of Israel have said in the last week that the Israeli intelligence services were warned of a pandemic coming from China in November, which was a month before the Chinese said that they'd got a problem. Now, how would the US intelligence services know that something was happening when the Chinese themselves didn't know it was happening? That's what's coming out things that are being said by the Times of Israel and by ABC News.
Yeah, okay, so
week.
I think it's pretty clear that what we were told a month ago about this being a short period of a few weeks of lockdown is simply not true. It's going to be extended possibly till the end of the year. And in the hope that this virus is going to come along, the vaccine is going to come along. Even though we know that this can reinfect people, this virus, that's what we're told, and therefore a vaccine is unlikely to be effective. There seems to be a kind of very basic failure of logic and rationality in what we're being told here.
Well, I mean, the idea of Gates is on the record as saying that he wants to actually push vaccination in the developing world anyway. And there's evidence, as Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has pointed out, that his previous vaccination efforts on polio in India and on tetanus in Kenya were absolutely criminally irresponsible in the minimum, and criminal in terms of actually giving people polio rather than vaccinating them from polio.
These things are
out there.
Martin, what Robert Kennedy's implying there is that the Gates Foundation was actually experimenting on people, and many of them were dying as a result of the so-called vaccines they were being given.
That's right. So in other words, the very least you could say is that Gates is very, very keen on pushing vaccination under any circumstances. And he definitely has raised the idea that people could have a chip injected into them, which would show their vaccination history and their health, you know, that you could be scanned and everybody would know immediately. And of course, the suggestion is that people would have this digital pass, that they were coronavirus free, and then they could go to football matches, whatever. But as you rightly point out, Tony, it's not even clear.
Martin, sorry to interrupt, but, you know, this ID 2020 that he's come up with could either be a physical card or it could be some sort of microchip implant. But the key thing here is surely that it might be that in order to do things like access benefits, access universal credit, or to go into supermarkets, use public transport, this seems to be what Gates is trying to get to happen here, is that you have to have this digital ID in order to get all these things. And that could mean that if you don't, you'll end up on the fringes of society, in poverty and possibly starving.
Well, I mean, we know that the USAID, the United States aid organization, which is basically a front for the US government and the CIA, pushed the Indians, the Modi government, to try and get rid of cash in India, which, of course, was absolutely disastrous for lots of small businesses and people who don't have bank accounts, and they had to stop doing it. But the idea of having everybody in a grid which can be monitored by the powers that be is definitely on the agenda. And you'd have thought that, you know, you might try that in a country like Switzerland, where most people probably have credit cards. But it'd be quite bizarre that the Indian government went along with it when perhaps half the population haven't got bank accounts. But there you are. They tried to do it. And that shows how important they seem to think it is.
This Gates article on CNBC talking about the Gates conspiracy theories. Gates apparently has stockpiled food, according to one theory, in his basement to prepare for a pandemic. And that was according to his wife, Melinda. And he gave a TED Talk speech in 2015 warning people that an infectious virus was a greater risk to humanity than nuclear war. What he didn't specify, Martin, in that talk was whether that would be a deliberately engineered virus or a natural one.
Well, obviously, he's claiming that there won't be any deliberate, you know, there is a danger from natural viruses. We know that. I mean, the interconnected nature of modern society makes us particularly vulnerable to these things. But nevertheless, there could be people developing biological weaponry. Now, in actual fact, biological weaponry is banned.
This may be biological weapon then.
Yes, biological weaponry in theory is banned. I saw quite an interesting comment, I think it was on the Moon of Alabama website, where they're pointing out that the US has got hundreds of biological research laboratories around the world. They're funded by the Pentagon. They're not funded by the health ministry. And they claim that they are developing what they're doing in these various places. Fort Detrick is obviously the port and down of this system, but they've got hundreds of others all over the place. Some of them are known about, some of them are not known about. And they've been claiming that they're developing mechanisms for dealing with biological attack. So we're not developing bioweapons ourselves, but other people may be. Don't say who, could be the Russians, could be the Chinese, could be terrorists like Osama bin Laden or whoever. They're developing these bioweapons. Therefore, we have to research so that we can deal with a bioweapon attack if it happens. And what's pointed out in this post is if that's what they were doing, they would have been ready for this virus. Because if it is a whether it's a bioweapon attack or not, the way you deal with it would be the same. You'd have to be able to, you know, trace people and all the rest of it, have the right hospital staff in place, etc. And quite clearly, they weren't doing any of that. So it's quite obvious that all of these facilities, which are funded by the US taxpayer, are in fact developing bioweapons. I don't think there's much doubt about that. And of course, they have used bioweapons in the past, in North Korea, for example, during the Korean War, and also against Cuba, where, you know, various pests and other things were infiltrated into the country. And of course, China has just had a massive African swine flu outbreak. Bird flu has decimated their chicken flock. And then something like this comes along. And I, as you know from last week's interview that we broadcast with the guy from the GRU, the Russian military intelligence services, they are actively looking into the idea that this is a bioweapons attack designed to destroy the Chinese economy and incidentally lead to a massive bailout of the banking system in the West, which was just about to collapse anyway. Unless you've got a coronavirus to cover it.
You're referring there to this interview with Vladimir Kovachkov, who's a colonel in the GRU, and he is effectively linking this to the 9/11 attacks. He's also linking it to what he says effectively is it's a biological stroke psychological warfare operation.
Yes, and I think those people who are saying that there is no real coronavirus out there, it's all basically hype by the evil Gates and all the rest of it, I tend to the view that it probably is a biological weapon and therefore incredibly dangerous. That's why it's got such a long incubation period. It doesn't kill loads of people. It just basically messes up the economy. And that's the purpose of it. You don't want to kill everybody. You just want to create a different circumstance for your plan, whatever it is. And of course, the 9/11 attacks, the Russian general staff, the Chinese general staff, the Iranian general staff are all very well aware that this was carried out from inside the US security forces, probably with collaboration with Mossad and with MI6. And anyway, people say, you can't say things like that. I say, well, this is just, that's their working assumption. And okay. I don't think they're wrong. And of course, that came, and if we come back to the 9/11 attacks, the follow-on attack from, with the anthrax letters that were sent out, that definitely traced back to Fort Detrick. No doubt about it. So some elements within the US security forces were definitely going around killing people to try and make the attack look worse than it otherwise would have done. So
CNBC, I'm going to try and drag you back to get your views on the Bill Gates and what were these so-called conspiracy theories. But this article really is what it's saying is that Bill Gates is spreading coronavirus. Well, that's not, I don't think there's anybody with half a brain cell that's saying that. What they're saying is that the programs for responding to it are all Gates programs, that his money is involved in Imperial College in London, at John Hopkins University, in doing the analysis, the day-to-day blow-by-blow accounts in real time. It's all Gates money that's doing that. And the pressure, the lobby that is on governments to have lockdowns, as in the UK and in the US, particularly severe ones, are from the Gates Foundation. In fact, he's saying there needs to be, just this week, there must be at least another 10 weeks of lockdown. That's what he's basically saying. And it's his policy that we're getting. We're not really getting any kind of independent policy either in Britain or in the US.
Well, it's not just Gates who's calling for lockdown. I come back to what I was saying a minute ago. If this is a bioweapon attack, then the lockdown may be the only thing you can do in the short run. The Chinese definitely went for a lockdown test and tracing approach. Basically, what they did is they switched into biological warfare attack mode, and they've been training for a biological warfare attack against them for years because they've expected that there was going to be something like this coming along the line.
Okay.
So, that's the reality.
Let's have a listen to a Syrian girl. Not quite sure what her real name is, but she's someone we've had on this show in the past, on and off. And she has done a summary based on lots and lots of mainstream and alternative media posts, a summary of what she makes of where we are now with this coronavirus. It's fairly long. I think it's about 7 minutes long, but we've got a lot to listen to. So we'll see if we can pull that apart when we've heard from Syrian girl. And the guy who introduces it is a German guy who's done a sort of little analysis of it as well. So he will be appearing at the start and the finish of her report.
The other day, Syrian girl, who by now probably long finished her PhD in chemistry in Australia, posted the following video summing up what we know about the history of the coronavirus. We know it, but the corporate media does not. They skipped over the fact that the virus had CRISPR cutting marks where the HIV virus was spliced into it.
You may have heard that Trump has defunded the World Health Organization and is considering firing Fauci. Bill Gates has been up in arms about this on Twitter. Even Lindsey Graham weighed in to ease the tensions between these two billionaires. You see, Bill Gates is the WHO's biggest donor, and Fauci is Bill Gates' right-hand man. While Trump doesn't want to take the fall for the coronavirus debacle, Bill Gates sees Trump as a threat to his business interests. You see, Bill is investing billions into producing a coronavirus vaccine that he intends to lace with a digital identifier called ID 2020. He needs the WHO to remain credible in order to advise people to take this vaccine. We've also been told that Bill Gates predicted the pandemic, but was it merely a prediction or something more? Today, we will discuss this, as well as Bill Gates' real agenda behind creating a vaccine with a digital ID. Roger Stone has come out and said what many are secretly thinking, that Bill Gates didn't predict the pandemic but caused it. Now, there's no evidence for this, but Bill Gates certainly agrees the pandemic could be man-made.
I think
an epidemic, either naturally caused or intentionally caused.
The uncanny timing of Bill Gates' predictions of a coronavirus pandemic has people questioning whether it was more than just an educated guess. On the 7th of November 2019, a Netflix documentary called The Next Pandemic was released, and it starred Bill Gates. This was 1 month before the first known case of COVID-19 was discovered in December, and the Chinese government hadn't even announced the outbreak until January 2020. As if the timing wasn't uncanny enough, that documentary stated that the next pandemic would be a coronavirus outbreak that might start at a Chinese wet market. In 2017, Dr. Fauci, who works with Bill Gates, stated with certainty that there would be an outbreak during Trump's presidency.
Is that there is no question that there will be a challenge to the coming administration in the arena of infectious diseases, both chronic infectious diseases in the sense of already ongoing disease, and we have certainly a large burden of that, but also there will be a surprise outbreak. There will be a surprise outbreak. There will be a surprise outbreak.
Another uncannily timed event occurred in October 2019, 2 months before the outbreak in China. Bill Gates hosted Event 201, which simulated the coronavirus pandemic. There's always a drill before the main event, isn't there? Also, in September of 2019, a few months before the outbreak, Bill Gates announced ID 2020, a plan to introduce vaccinations with digital ID. Last month, Bill Gates did an AMA where he suggested a coronavirus vaccine could come with a digital certificate. He passed it off as a faraway hypothetical concept and didn't mention the fact he had been investing in it, nor did he mention that he wants to tattoo that digital certificate into people's skin with quantum dots that will be visible with smartphones. Essentially, he wants to tattoo a Microsoft logo on everyone, so it's not just herd immunity, but herd branding. He stated that we won't be allowed to travel or leave our homes unless we accept this vaccine.
Eventually, what we'll have to have is certificates of who's a recovered person, who's a vaccinated person, because you don't want people moving around the world where you'll have some countries that won't have it under control, sadly. You don't want to completely block off the ability for those, you know, people to go there and come back and move around. So eventually there will be sort of this digital immunity proof that, you know, will help facilitate the global reopening up.
You may think this plan seems far-fetched, but the British government has already embraced it.
We are looking at an immunity certificate, how we can how people who have had the disease have got the antibodies and therefore have immunity can show that.
The general public may be harder to convince, so they're going to sell them the idea step by step. First, they will suggest that those who have already survived coronavirus and acquired antibodies will be given special privileges, which were previously our rights, such as the ability to travel, go back to work, or even leave our homes. Most people would find this idea quite reasonable given the dangers of the virus. However, the implications of this are already dystopian. Out of economic desperation, some may choose to purposely infect themselves with the virus in order to gain antibodies. But we don't even know if you can become immune after contracting coronavirus. There have been reports of reinfection, and the virus is constantly mutating. There's even a chance that the virus could be more deadly if you catch it the second time, because your immune system might hyper-respond.
If you contract COVID-19 and survive it, you might be entitled to what is called an immunity passport.
Once people accept this scenario, they'll suggest that only those who have been vaccinated can leave their homes. Anyone who refuses will remain under house arrest. In this way, they won't have to make taking vaccines compulsory, but they can make life unlivable if you refuse. This won't just be for coronavirus. This will eventually apply to other viruses too. Imagine a world where people born with HIV are no longer allowed to travel and are completely isolated from society. Imagine having to declare your entire medical history before entering a building. Imagine those without coronavirus antibodies being forced to wear a star and placed in isolation camps. This won't stop at viruses. Once our God-given freedoms are labeled as privileges that can be taken away, the concept will extend to social credit systems. Perhaps, if you become an enemy of the state, you won't be able to even purchase groceries because your digital identifier will block you from doing so.
You know, if you go out and you want to buy groceries, you need a picture on a card. You need ID. You go out and you want to buy anything. You need ID and you need your picture.
Not yet, Trump. Not yet. I think you've revealed too much. And what happens if you refuse the tattoo?
Right, so that'll be this many dollars. And if you could just go ahead and, like, put your tattoo in that shit.
What are the odds?
Where's your tattoo? Tattoo.
So why is Bill Gates doing this? Does he really care about public health or the spread of coronavirus? People's first instincts may be to conclude this is all about money. And that's part of it. Bill Gates wants to monopolize vaccines. Microsoft follows a strategy to take their competition out of business called Embrace, Extend, Extinguish, which they got sued for. Perhaps they're applying this concept to vaccines. Embrace them, extend them to include digital ID, and then extinguish any of your competition. Thereby, making a Bill Gates branded vaccine, which has a digital ID, far more likely to be the one that's accepted by governments. But it's not all about profit. Bill Gates' agenda is much worse. It's eugenics. Bill Gates has openly stated that one of his goals is to lower the world's population because of global warming. Bill Gates gets his eugenicist ideas from his father, who was the head of Planned Parenthood. This didn't stop him from having three kids of his own, though. He even went as far as to admit he wants to lower the world's population through the use of vaccines.
So you've got a thing on the left, CO2, that you want to get to zero, and that's going to be based on the number of people, the services each person's using on average, the energy on average for each service, and the CO2 being put out per unit of energy. So let's look at each one of these and see how we can get this down to zero. Probably one of these numbers is going to have to get pretty near to zero. Now that's back from high school algebra. But let's take a look. First we've got population. Now the world today has 6.8 billion people. That's headed up to about 9 billion. Now if we do a really great job on new vaccines, healthcare, reproductive health services, we could lower that by perhaps 10 or 15%.
But how can one achieve population control with a vaccine? Well, the World Health Organization has a patent on a tetanus vaccine that causes infertility because of an autoimmune response. They called the infertility a design feature of the vaccine. There were accusations that the tetanus vaccine was used in Kenya to make women infertile. It's the WHO that has this patent, but as we know, Bill Gates is the number one sponsor of the WHO through his Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and his Gavi Alliance. There are currently lawsuits being filed by girls in Australia who believe the Gardasil vaccine caused their ovaries to fail. Bill Gates is also funding a program to mutilate the genitals of little African boys. It's also not encouraging to know that Gates has already filed for indemnity insurance for any future coronavirus vaccine that he produces, so that if he ends up killing people, he can't be sued. You see, Bill Gates can also reduce the world's population with this new coronavirus vaccine. For some diseases, the vaccine can make catching the virus even more deadly by making the immune system's response work against the body in what is called antibody-dependent enhancement.
And there are diseases
in which you vaccinate someone. They get infected with what you're trying to protect them with, and you actually enhance the infection. You can get a good feel for that in animal models.
This was the case in the original SARS vaccine that was trialed in animals. And as we know, COVID-19 is a type of SARS, so it's likely going to face the same problem. Except Bill Gates is skipping the animal trials this time. How can we trust a man with our healthcare while he openly says he wants to depopulate the world? How can we trust a man to stop coronavirus when he can't keep viruses from invading his own Windows operating system? How can we trust a man who has failed to keep vaccines safe in the past? Robert Kennedy made a post on his Instagram pointing out that Bill Gates' vaccine programs have resulted in deaths and paralysis. Even the WHO admitted a mutant strain of polio resulted from their vaccine program paralyzed more people than wild polio. When Bill Gates made education his goal, he forced Common Core onto America, which he admits was a complete failure, but also doubled down on. When he made the environment his goal, he almost destroyed the Earth with a wacky cloud whitening idea to end global warming. How could one man be allowed to wield that much power when he isn't elected? He also isn't a self-made billionaire. He's a college dropout whose parents were rich and well-connected. In fact, he keeps some pretty unscrupulous associates. Bill Gates agreed to associate with Jeffrey Epstein after he was convicted of raping a child. He said of that relationship, "His lifestyle is intriguing." Would you let an associate of Jeffrey Epstein inject you with an unknown substance? It's also bizarre that Microsoft chose now to feature spirit cooker Marina Abramovic in their advertisements, fueling rumors of occult agendas. Philanthropic billionaires like Bill Gates and George Soros, who claim to be giving away their money, are not to be trusted.
Oh, I didn't get rich by writing a lot of checks.
Remember that he tried to deprive the co-founder of Microsoft of his share of the money. So say no to the digital ID. But be cautious of dialectics that are being set up. Just because you don't trust a vaccine that comes from Bill Gates doesn't mean you don't believe vaccines work. Just because you believe in the right to bodily autonomy and don't trust certain pharmaceutical companies doesn't mean that you don't believe in vaccination programs. Just because Bill Gates is pushing his agenda through the coronavirus pandemic doesn't mean the virus is a hoax. This episode of The Simpsons may explain this point well.
We're here to come up with the next phony baloney crisis to put Americans back where they belong, in dark rooms glued to their televisions too terrified to skip the commercials. I think we should go with a good old-fashioned public health scare.
Yeah.
A new disease. No one's immune. It's like the summer of the shark, except instead of a shark, it's an epidemic. And instead of summer, it's all the time.
That is smoking.
Janice, we do have standards. This can't be a made-up disease. The only moral thing to do is release a deadly virus into the general public.
George Martinson at Peak Prosperity, who has a PhD in toxicology, has been following the virus on YouTube. He says this virus will be with us for a while, and that it will very likely mutate and come back again and again, killing us again and again, because vaccines probably won't work. And if one does, we face an even worse fate. Digital certificates from Bill Gates will allow us to leave our homes, go to work, and buy food. Bill Gates will even let us renew our driver's license and be molested at airports by TSA if he likes us and does not cancel our certificates and our access to our bank accounts and credit cards. Talk about Mark of the Beast. Too bad for Bill and the globalists that gold and silver coins are not digital. John F. Kennedy Jr. published his interview with Bill Gates in George magazine. I actually talked to his sister Caroline Kennedy, who said her brother named the magazine after George Washington because he greatly admired George Washington and the founding fathers. JFK Jr. died in a plane crash on July 6, 1999 at Martha's Vineyard. Barry Chamish, who had written a lot on the assassination of Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, critical of the Israeli government's involvement, said that the Mossad had a motive to kill JFK Jr. to stop the forthcoming article. But John Jr. was thinking of running for the Senate in New York against Hillary Clinton. Another definite no-no. In this interview, Bill Gates, in February of 1997, says that in 2020, the worst-case scenario is an overpopulated planet choked to extinction by a lung-attacking virus. The following is from George Webb's Twitter feed. George, February 97 issue. Platform 2020 discussed by Bill Gates with John F. Kennedy Jr. Worst-case scenario, an overpopulated planet choked by lung-attacking virus. This all started when I saw the video from Syrian Girl. I posted it on a forum and got responses online by Jim and by email from Bob in D.C. Inquiring minds want to know how Bill Gates back in 1997 could predict our future in 2020.
So that's Syrian Girl along with the German commentator at the beginning and the start, looking at this fascinating idea of a very, very long period that Bill Gates has been predicting and looking at this. And interesting that he decided to call his digital ID program ID 2020. I mean, it could be that this has been engineered, but it could be that it's just that Bill Gates is an incredible prophet. But one of the amazing aspects to all of this, of course, is that vaccines quite regularly do cause much more of a problem for people than they're supposed to actually be solving. And one of the reasons for this is because in 1986 in the United States, a law was passed absolving vaccine manufacturers from liability. US Congress passed something called the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act, the NCVIA, which was to leave judgments about vaccine design to the Federal Drug Administration, the National Vaccine Program, rather than juries. So in other words, saying that if a parent has a child vaccinated and that child then either gets some sort of disease or dies, that there's no recourse in law to the vaccine program. So this does sort of suggest that vaccines for a long, long time, Martin, have been something which has been not necessarily as safe as we would have hoped they have, especially since you can't, if you believe you've been injured by a vaccine in the US, you're not allowed to go to court in order to sue the vaccine manufacturer or the person that decided to give you that vaccine.
Well, I think Syrian Girl made a very good point, which is criticizing the way Bill Gates does business doesn't mean that we're saying that all vaccination is wrong. Vaccination has obviously worked in some in the past in some cases, you know, but on the other hand, we've got to be eternally vigilant about people who are pushing basically crackpot solutions. It's not even clear that there is a vaccine for this disease. And what Gates has been pushing for years is this idea of basically the human population being chipped and controlled. And that's what he's about. And of course, the exercise that they ran where they all practiced having a pandemic virus.
Oh, this is, you're
attack.
Talking about Event 201.
Yeah, Event 201. Well, a major participant in Event 201, apart from Bill Gates, was none other than the Central Intelligence Agency of the United States, the CIA, who are very, very chummy with Gates. So Gates isn't just necessarily some Bond villain working on his own. He's working in line with the deep state in the United States, who've got a strategic goal, which they boast from the rooftops, of defeating China and containing Russia. And I think that is what's underlying all of this. It's very clear, whether it was accidental or deliberate, the policy is to try and wreck the Chinese economy, to prevent them having the Belt and Road Initiative, to continue the dominance of Wall Street, the dollar Wall Street regime, as Peter Gowen used to call it, over the global economy. And incidentally, of course, they've managed to massively bail out the failing hedge funds, etc., in the US. And the market was going to crash anyway, but the coronavirus means that A, people are distracted by the coronavirus, and B, they don't question the fact that the market's been bailed out. Now, what should have happened, in my view, economically, is you bail the people out, you give them a universal income, and you let the banks collapse and the people, like Gates, lose their money. That's capitalism.
Well,
Bill Gates, you're bankrupt.
There's another stage to all of this, and that is the David Beasley, who is the boss of the World Food Programme this week, has said, well, on the back of all this, we could be looking at food shortages of biblical proportions. Now, that
wasn't that's right.
That wasn't part of the deal, was it, when we first heard a month ago about these lockdowns?
Yeah, but the lockdowns are, in a sense, the lockdowns are just what you... If it is a bioweapon, and I believe it is, Tony, the lockdown is what you have to do. The Chinese haven't failed on that. They've recognised immediately, if we're under attack, we've got to respond as if we are under attack. And Xi Jinping referred to it as a people's war to begin with. Now, that the real problem is that we're now going to have massive economic damage in developing countries. They're all going to the IMF to demand money.
Now, you're saying the lockdowns are necessary. I'm saying they're definitely not necessary, since what we've seen in some countries like South Korea and Sweden prove that. And the idea here is that you can have still some economic activity within different rules, and you can allow people who may have a very, very low risk of actually dying of the coronavirus carry on almost as normal, with maybe some sort of physical distancing rules. That the idea that you've got to have a massive lockdown is really treating every single person in your society as if they're one of the most vulnerable, which they're not.
All right. Well, I mean, this is a debate about lockdowns. The South Koreans didn't have a lockdown because they traced everybody. The Chinese did have a lockdown in Wuhan province, which is as big as a European country in terms of numbers, because they treated it as a bio-warfare attack, which is probably what it is. Now, leaving aside the whether we should release lockdowns or whatever, these are secondary questions. If this is a bio-warfare attack, and I believe it is, and you've got the collapse of the Western stock markets, which has been bailed out by the Federal Reserve, which is actually acting way beyond its mandate in doing that, they shouldn't be doing that. That's not in their mandate to do any of this, but they've just thrown the mandate out of the window. We are basically in the early phases of World War III. That's what we're talking about. And they're going to have to fight it with coronavirus are out there. Look at the two aircraft carriers that the Americans have got, which and the French, the Charles de Gaulle, all non-functional because of coronavirus. Incidentally, there's a very interesting article in the Saker about this, pointing out that Russian military ships have got a sprinkler system which allows you to wash down the whole ship. So they're not just against fire. You get the crew off the ship, you switch on the sprinkler system, and it washes down the whole ship, so it washes out any virus in the ship. The Americans haven't got that on their ship.
Actually, I mean, that's also potentially very useful for washing it, nuclear fallout, for example. It's a very, very
indeed
good thing to have.
Well, I mean, but what happened with one of the American ships after the Fukushima disaster is they sailed the aircraft carrier into the plume that was coming off the Fukushima, and then the whole ship took all the radiation in through its air vents, and then became and then had to be de-radiated because it was completely covered in radiation. Now, I think it's fairly clear that the military in China, Russia and Iran are already working on the assumption that this is a biowarfare attack, and they're deploying themselves accordingly. But I think it's very significant that they are still having lockdowns in China, Russia and Iran because it's a biowarfare attack. They're not arguing about lockdowns. We're under attack here. We've got to respond in a military way.
But why aren't they saying this publicly then?
Because they don't really want to go to war. They're trying to find a way to negotiate behind the scenes. So the official position of the Russian government is not what we heard from the GRU colonel last week. But what they're trying to do is communicate to those who are listening, we think this is a biowarfare attack, whilst keeping the door open to negotiations with the West, because they don't really want World War III. Who wants it? I don't. Do you?
So some of the other stories buried this week, I mean, there's always seems to be something that there's not being discussed, but the major ones really seem to be to do with the war of words, which is continuing. I mean, it's almost like, you know, the fall of the Berlin Wall, everyone was hoping for the peace dividend that never came. We're now in a situation where this virus could mean that some of the global tensions, for example, the war in Yemen, the tension between the US and Iran, could be diffused. But that's not happening at all.
No, it's not. I think it's pretty clear that if the deep state are behind this, that they're also going to ramp up. Look at the statements by Pompeo, who's also said this is an exercise. he said that on camera. Whether it was a slip of the tongue, we don't know. But they're certainly pushing and pressure on Iran, on China. Don't forget there was a trade war with China before all this started, which was just about getting close to crashing the world economy. There was an ongoing sanctions war against Iran. There was the assassination of Soleimani, which we began 2020 with, which was basically as provocative as you could possibly get. It's a bit like the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand in 1914. And then this comes along. And I think what's actually happening, Tony, is that the military in the enemy countries have already drawn the correct conclusions about this. The Chinese ambassador to Russia, I mentioned this earlier, I've sent you a link to this, what he said. Now, what he said is quite interesting in that he's saying we don't accept that it started in Wuhan. Our scientists are now pointing that it came from somewhere else, but he isn't saying it's deliberate. And he's doing that because they're trying to keep options open. But I'm quite sure that the hardliners in China and Russia have already made their minds up. This is an attack and we're at war.
Well, one of the things that Syrian Girl talked about there was this Marina Abramovich Microsoft released then and deleted an ad with the elite occultist Marina Abramovich. This is reported in the Vigilant Citizen. And I think it might actually be helpful to go through some of the good websites, because I think some internet news services, websites or whatever, blogs, have really shone during this coronavirus crisis as providing some very well stood up analysis and really, I suppose, criticizing government responses, criticizing what some so-called experts who have hidden money behind them, you know, the sort of thing who were revealed by the Spinwatch website run by David Miller, who's here at Bristol University, looking at the money behind some of these so-called independent experts. But on Good Friday, Microsoft released a video promoting its association with the elite's favourite artist, Marina Abramovich. After a massive backlash, the video was set to private and all traces of the campaign were scrubbed from Microsoft's official website. So this woman, it was to promote a mixed reality device, HoloLens 2. Microsoft teamed up with the occultist Marina Abramovich to create an art project called The Life. In a promotional video posted on the YouTube account, she is described as the most legendary performance artist working now. Well, she's a bit peculiar. I don't know if you've seen any of her stuff to do with spirit cooking, Martin, but she does these very disturbing artworks using pig's blood and pig's organs and goes to parties where they have hopefully anyway, fake human body parts cooked for people to eat at the party. So why on earth would Microsoft be using her as some sort of promotional tool? And then they've obviously decided, it was released on Good Friday, of course, which is significant from religious terms. Maybe this is just a twos up at religion by Microsoft. A very peculiar advertising campaign to do kind of mega gory ads and then take them down.
Well, it's very suspicious, isn't it? We don't really know what's going on there. We do know, for example, that before 9/11, there was an art installation in the Twin Towers, which was being set up by Israeli art students. And what on earth was that about? And I've even seen photographs of the installation itself, which was like a sort of a balcony being pushed out on one of the floors. Now, what were they doing in there? What was going on in that situation? Of course, loads of art students were arrested by the DEA in the US just before 9/11. And they were being arrested because they were involved with the ecstasy smuggling. But it turned out to be linked to the Israeli intelligence services, just like Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell. Now, these things have been going on for a long time. And as I said earlier, we can chat about it on Zoom as we are now. But I think that the military intelligence of the major powers are already moving on this. And as I said earlier, ABC News and Times of Israel suggest that the Israeli intelligence services were warned of a pandemic in China in November by the US intelligence services. And of course, we can put a link up to that because I've sent you the details.
Okay, so, yeah, we'll put a link up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk to that one. The next, I thought we could have a look through some of these blogs and independent news sites. So I was just talking about Vigilant Citizen there. Another is Mint Press News, which you've pointed out a few times, Martin, with Whitney Webb. Has been doing some very good work on exposing some of the existing stuff floating around in the old-fashioned mainstream media, which has been pulled together to show that some of the, basically some of the problems may be with this virus may be originated in Fort Detrick in Maryland. So Whitney Webb is on there, but another story that's on there at the moment is about sanctioned countries. Sanctioned countries apparently are now leading the world in the fight against coronavirus. Countries currently facing US sanctions, around a quarter of the world's population, are faring far better than the US and leading the global fight against COVID-19.
Well, I think the Venezuelans, because they're under sanctions by the US, have handled the coronavirus situation quite well. I've sent you a link to an article about that. Because, of course, if you're under sanctions, Cuba has managed reasonably well as well, because they're under sanctions. And if you're under sanctions, you don't have a lot of people coming and going, and you have to struggle to find foreign exchange and so on. But it means if you've got a mobilized population, what happened in Venezuela is they shut the borders. They said, if you've got any symptoms, contact us on this website. 20,000 people did, and all of those people were visited within the next 2 days and tested. And that's how they dealt with it. And of course, they've got a lockdown going on because basically they are at war with the United States of America. This is all ultimately going to resolve itself as a military problem, I fear.
And then another website which has been shining is called Off Guardian. There's an article on there at the moment, which is just uploaded a couple of days ago. The headline is Why You Can't Trust the UK's Daily COVID-19 Updates. Well, it's all very well watching someone on TV or listening to the radio sounding confidently that they know what's going on. But the daily COVID-19 death reports issued by UK government, Off Guardian says, are generally misleading and being so misrepresented by the media as they amount to little more than a lie. Each day, the UK's Department of Health and Social Care releases a report entitled Daily Number of COVID-19 Associated UK Deaths in Hospital. The media then report these numbers as the daily death toll, presented as if all these people, A, died of COVID-19, and B, died in the preceding 24 hours, neither of which is true. So they're looking at this whole thing of lies, damn lies and statistics, Martin.
Well, that's right. And of course, they are off-guarding, as I understand it, are generally of the view that there is no coronavirus and it's all a psychological warfare operation.
No, I don't think that's the case. No, that they're pulling apart the analysis that the government is giving, and they're saying, well, actually, what they're telling you is a skewed version of the facts, and they're not being frank and honest.
Well, know, they're probably, in my view, underestimating the tally. Because they weren't counting people who died at home or people who died in care homes. Now, the Moon of Alabama people are, which a website I use, and the Saker, the Saker doesn't believe that it's a bioweapon. I think he's wrong about that. Moon of Alabama are, the German guy behind that is not sure about that. I think that there's an awful lot of that we don't know. And no more than the government, though. I mean, I don't think people like Matt Hancock are in on this. I don't think Boris Johnson is in on this. Boris Johnson obviously wasn't informed when Trump and Pompeo made the decision to assassinate Soleimani. They didn't bother to consult the British Prime Minister. Why would they? And so, therefore, I don't think Trump has been involved in this either. Trump famously said after 9/11, the buildings must have been bombed because buildings like that don't collapse like that. Giuliani, who's his lawyer, was also, we've got evidence that he was aware that there was something going on. But Trump clearly is a chump and doesn't know what's going on.
Okay, well, look, going back to Off Guardian, and Rosemary Fry is writing there. She's saying her headline is The Seven-Step Path from Pandemic to Totalitarianism. There are just seven steps, she says, from pandemic declaration to permanent totalitarianism. and many jurisdictions are about to start step five, she says. This is Rosemary Fry in Off Guardian. She says, and I'll briefly summarise what those steps are. She says, step one, a new virus starts to spread around the world. The World Health Organization declares a pandemic. Then she says, step two, national, state, provincial, municipal leaders, public health officials start daily press briefings. They pump out statistics and modelling, asserting that the virus has the potential to kill tens of millions of people. Then step three, she says, there's a concerted effort by all levels of government and public health to ramp up testing for viral DNA, and they push aside the need for regulation at that point, bringing in social isolation. She then says, step four is when the number of cases and deaths start to plateau. Local officials claim it's too early to tell whether the virus has finished passing through their population. Therefore, the restrictive measures must continue. That was step four. Step five is about 2 or 3 weeks later. The dramatic increase in testing produces the desired goal of a significant upsurge in the number of people found to be testing positive for the virus. Then she says step six, large-scale human testing of many different types of antivirals and vaccines begins thanks to a concerted push from the World Health Organization, Bill Gates and his collaborators, pharmaceutical and biotech companies, governments and universities. Finally, step seven, soon the new virus starts another cycle around the globe, just as influenza and other viruses have every year for millennia. Officials again fanned the flames of fear by positing the potential for tens of millions of deaths among people not yet protected from the virus. So there's a brief summary. And of course, one of the most interesting steps there is that, you know, we'll be looking potentially here anyway at a significant upsurge in the figures because, not because there's more people with the virus, but because the testing is becoming much more effective.
Well, I think that's all speculation, isn't it? I mean, the fact is, what she seems to be suggesting is that the Chinese Communist Party military and intelligence services are in on this with the US deep state, and that they are together cooperating to try and pull the wool over our eyes.
That's misrepresenting what she's saying. I think, you know, what she's saying there is that due to this whole idea of having these enforced national lockdowns with no way out, with everybody, however vulnerable they are to this, being forced to lock down, what you're doing is you're locking yourself into a pretty horrific no exit strategy, which is in fact what we were hearing with Gary Hopkins earlier, Matt Hancock talking about. They just don't know how they're going to get out of it at the moment.
Well, maybe there isn't a way out of it. I put it to you, what was the exit strategy from the Black Death? And the only thing that worked there just about is isolation, quarantine, people staying away from people who are ill, burning the clothes of people who are infected, getting rid of the bodies quickly and without people touching them.
Well,
too.
I mean, there is a way out, and that's been proved by the South Koreans and the Swedes, thank God. You know, they've
The South Koreans have done the best, but they did it by, again, they're a militarized society. They treated it as a biowarfare attack, possibly because the Chinese had tipped them off. And of course, it's not clear that it won't come back. And don't forget, there may be no jobs to go back to. If the derivatives market crashes, as it may well do in the next few weeks, the whole world economy will go down the drain and there's no jobs to go back to. The virus may still be out there, but by that time, the shooting war in the South China Sea or the Strait of Hormuz, which you mentioned earlier, may already have started. And that's what we're at. The coronavirus is in a sense just a trigger for the collapse of the geopolitical system that we've been living under since 9/11. But of course, this is the real problem. And of course, in South Africa and India and all these other places, poor people are dying already from preventable diseases and they can't earn a living and all the rest of it. And the coronavirus is just a contingent factor in that. But of course, all of the developing countries, because of the dollar going up in price because of the safe haven effect, all of their national finances are being ruined. And the IMF is saying, all right, well, we'll have to go into all of these countries. And that just means basically the IMF gets their teeth into them. And both Venezuela and Iran, who have been forbidden to get IMF money, are so desperate they've asked for IMF money. And the Americans who run the IMF and said, you can whistle for that. So that's what we're looking at here. I think we're looking at a World War III scenario, Tony, not a coronavirus scenario. The coronavirus is just the immediate trigger.
And interesting, isn't it, that we may be coming towards a large global war, but the population of Britain has its movements already restricted. It's almost as if we're looking at kind of wartime movement restrictions, even worse sometimes than in, say, an occupied Nazi Europe, when we go into that war.
Yeah, and of course, if it is a biological weapon, Tony, it's dangerous. It's not just being made up. The Chinese have treated it as if it's dangerous. That's because they probably know more than we do about what it is. And that's why they're basically preparing to, both the Russians and the Chinese are absolutely clear, we are preparing to fight the United States of America and their British friends, and their Israeli friends as well. We're going there. That's where we're going.
Well, one other story, let's just finish on, because one of the most important places that we go for news is YouTube. We'll find all sorts of things on there. And the boss of YouTube this week, Susan Wojcicki, has said that she will take down any videos which talk about vitamin C as being some sort of cure for what she calls the Chinese virus. We'll take it down, she says. Actually, this is one thing we're not really hearing very much about at all. I'm really quite shocked to see. One of the reasons that people will not die of this is if their immune system is in a good condition. And I'm absolutely amazed that there's been no talk from the health secretary or anybody else about making sure that people are taking daily doses of vitamin C and zinc, which are the two vitamins, minerals, which are the best for making sure you've got a good immune system, a healthy immune system, because if and when you do get this virus, it means that you get a bit of a head start on being able to deal with it. And so helping your natural immunity seems to take absolutely no part in the government's or the mass media's response, Martin. I haven't heard one single person talking about, the idea of actually making sure you've got a bit of a stronger immune system to give yourself a better chance of surviving.
Well, one of the problems with the virus, and we're only learning about it as we go, is what they call a cytokine storm. A cytokine storm is that your body starts, immune system overreacts. And one interesting thing that's happened in France is that, and the Chinese have also flagged this up, is that smokers do not seem to contract coronavirus. And it may be that because they've lowered their immune systems by smoking, that the trigger effect, which creates this storm in your body, is prevented. And that in France, they are now experimenting by giving frontline workers nicotine patches. They're not saying, they think it's possibly nicotine that's doing that, that's creating this.
But it could also possibly be put the tar in people's lungs, couldn't it? Maybe.
We don't know. But this is the whole idea that this is some kind of flu, and we've just got to treat it like flu. If it's a bioweapon, that doesn't hold. It could be anything, and we just don't know. But you can imagine that the top military doctors in Russia and China are looking into this very, very carefully, because they're now going to have to fight, just like the Syrian army is going to have to fight with this in the atmosphere. And of course, the other thing that hasn't been covered this week, but it's still pretty significant, is the prevention of chemical weapons. People have claimed that the Douma attack definitely was carried out by the Syrian government, which gives the casus belli to the Western powers again, even though in actual fact the people who carried out the investigation in Douma, the actual people on the ground, have already spoken up and said that's rubbish. We've got no evidence of a chemical weapons attack here. But of course, under normal circumstances, we'd be talking about that. We'd be talking about what's happening in Idlib province. We'd be talking about Yemen. We'd be talking about all of these things, but instead we're talking about coronavirus. And of course, there is possibly going to be some kind of showdown in the South China Sea. This is where we're going. And that we hardly notice it. Everybody's too busy talking about something else.
So thanks, Martin. That was Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Thanks also to the clip with Syrian girl. Thanks to her. And thanks also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. You can download our MP3s. You can listen in the car anywhere you like if you want. And you'll find this show's podcast, story links and comment page and our contact details at thisweekoneword.org. bbc.co.uk. If you'd like to see us back on FM, do please use that website to contact BCFM and ask for the show to go back on FM. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. Do please join us for the BCFM Emergency Schedule Politics Show online on Friday or on FM 10 p.m. on Monday, or so we're told by BCFM managers. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.